This is CliffCentral.com.
I talk to South Africans all the time and go, oh, but isn't the Mediterranean just north of the Limpopo? I don't count that whole huge swathe of a continent, which is so multicultural, so diverse, so incredibly interesting, and historically just pockmarked with some of the most ugly scenes in human history. You know, there are things there that just beggar belief, and I'm not talking about Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. I'm talking about what actually happened in places like the Congo for hundreds of years and things that are just not documented well enough. And we've luckily got this morning someone who I love to talk to about Africa because he spends most of his time traveling around, gathering the stories together, finding out what the truth is, and putting it together in an African context, which is so important. I'm talking about Simon Allison. He is at the Mail and Guardian. He is their Africa editor. And that is a very, very important role, which probably he should have a whole department under him. I hope you do, Simon. How are you?
Me and my department of one are fantastic.
One? What is wrong with these people?
Honestly.
Seriously, I mean, there's so much to talk about in Africa, and you've got one person in your department?
You know, it's a bit of a crisis across South African media in general. I think the Mail and Guardian is the only publication currently with a full-time Africa editor or full-time Africa department.
Why do you think that is? Is there not enough interest? Because I would imagine there must be huge interest in Africa. Is it,
you know, there is
it under-resourced?
You know, and we can really tell the amount of interest because these days you can see the clicks. You can see how many people are reading the stories. People read the stories. People want to know about the rest of the continent. Of course, we know, you know, our businesses are there already. The clever ones. They're out there. They're making money.
Right.
They're desperate for news. I think most people, most ordinary readers are too, but it's not particularly commercially viable.
Okay, so here's where I mean, that may be true, but people have got to wake up because I keep saying, and it's, you can contradict me if I'm wrong, but this is the largest population in the world of unsaturated consumers, and particularly young unsaturated consumers. So if you're looking to sell stuff, this is the place you've got to look. And it's huge. So there's so many opportunities to be exploited.
No, from a business perspective, Africa is the future. And it's quite incredible because it's almost like the sort of global hyenas have realized this. And they
Donald Trump in that speech of his yesterday.
But he wasn't wrong when he said, you know, my friends like Africa because they go there to make money.
Right.
That is really how many people from outside the continent view it. And you've got the Americans. You've got the EU has this EU Africa summit.
Mm-hmm.
Egypt is having an Egypt Africa summit, which is kind of ridiculous because Egypt is in Africa.
I don't think they are. They've got the same problem we
exactly,
have.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, the Gulf states are suddenly getting really, really interested in putting in big money here. Because
we know China has for the longest
China
time.
China has, absolutely. India, everyone is like, okay, where are we going to go next? All our usual suspects are, you know, pretty much saturated. Africa, let's go to Africa. Let's see what's happening there. And so this presents great opportunities, of course, you know.
But then
we are the darling of the world.
The corollary to that is we've got to get our act together. And there are so many countries in Africa that are full of potential, but they're run by idiots or despots or both.
Mm.
And here in South Africa, we don't really pay much attention to the politics of every other country to the north of us. Just recently, and I think we should start with Kenya, if you don't mind. Mm. I've got a whole checklist I want to go through with you. So let's start with Kenya. What is going on there? Because I understood there was an election. Then the constitutional, the high or the Supreme Court decided that election was invalid and they needed to do it again. Where are we at the moment?
Well, it's a good question. So yesterday or the day before, Wednesday, the Supreme Court finally, because what they'd said is they're like, look, this election is not legit. We're going to scrap it. We're going to annul the election, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we have to read that as a sign of the strength of the Kenyan democracy. You know, of course, it's got so many flaws, but here is this major institution, like in South Africa, where the courts have come in repeatedly to put things on the right path. You've got the Supreme Court saying, hey, this was bullshit. We're going to do this again. That's great. Yesterday, or the
Who was it? Is Odinga still involved there?
Yeah, so it's
and
Uhuru
Kenyatta,
who's the president on the one side, and Raila Odinga, the main opposition leader. And their history is fascinating because, of course, Uhuru Kenyatta, he's the son of Jomo Kenyatta, who's Kenya's founding father.
Right.
But Raila Odinga is the son of Odinga Odinga, who was Kenyatta's nemesis back in the day. So in a way, we're replaying these generational rivalries on the modern stage.
Isn't it interesting? And in Botswana, we've got Ian Khama, who's Tsiretse Khama's son.
Exactly.
We have a number of kind of dynastic rulers in Africa, don't we? I mean, obviously the other one is Kabila.
Kabila's another one.
Joseph Kabila.
We've got plenty. I think it's a world thing. You know, in Thailand, you had the Shinawatras. Watchers. In
America, you had the Bushes.
In America, you had the Bushes. And then you nearly had the Clintons. Yeah. And most of the world would have been pretty happy for a Clinton dynasty in the U.S. as compared to what we have now.
All right. But going back to Kenya, so what's the problem here? Why did they say that the election was suspicious or irregular?
Manipulated.
Because it was just so suspicious. Well. Even before the vote happened, I think it was just a few days before the election was supposed to happen. A guy called Chris, I think his name was Chris Masondo. He was the head of IT at the electoral board. He was the guy in charge of getting all the systems in place, you know, and they've just introduced new electronic voting, which is really exciting. He's the head of IT. He's the guy responsible for implementing it. He was murdered.
Oh.
There we go.
I'm like, whoa.
Ding, ding, ding.
And you know, the way Kenya had set themselves up is that the servers that handled all of that traffic were in an undisclosed location so that no one could find them. Chris was one of the few people who knew where those servers were, and there was evidence that he was tortured before he was killed. So now immediately, I mean, this is the biggest possible red flags you've got going. And then there were all kinds of other things on election day. And 2 days ago, the Supreme Court finally released its full reasoning. And basically they said, look guys, the Electoral Commission was just so bad that there's no way these elections could have been free and fair. It was like terribly organized. The security lapses all along the way. They didn't give all the forms and the signatures and the, you know, all the stuff you need to verify the results. That just didn't happen in huge amounts of cases.
Sort of like what's happened in KZN.
Well,
in the ANC.
So then what's going to happen next, and how are they going to try and avoid?
This is the paradox, right? Because new election scheduled for 26th of October.
Right.
Great. We're going to do this again, and it's going to be free, fair, and clean, and happy. But how the hell is Kenya going to pull this off? How are they going to fix their electoral commission, which has just been found to be basically entirely corrupt? How are they going to pay for it? Because do you know how expensive elections are?
Yeah.
We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. Kenya's not a rich country. They've just paid for one election. Now they have to pay for a new election. How are they going to do that? And are the political parties involved going to accept the results anyway?
What I'm interested in is this corruption at the Electoral Commission. Would this have worked in favor of Kenyatta or in favor of Odinga?
In favor of Kenyatta. So Kenyatta won by about 5% in the election that was annulled. Huh. And he is furious. He has said that he's going to fix the judiciary. He said they're staging a judicial coup, and he's going to take care of them. And what's quite interesting is, so he said all this, he got very angry, and of course his supporters loved it. But the Chief Justice, David Maraga, he's from a place called Kisi region, which has quite a lot of voters, and it's quite split, so it's a swing state. Kisi is really pissed off that Kenyatta is attacking the Chief Justice, and all of the Jubilee voters, the Kenyatta's voters, are now moving over to Odinga.
Oh.
So his reaction is kind of coming back to
precipitated
bite
some ugly results. Mm. Okay, so Kenya's in flux.
Yes, very much so.
Do you have hope that this next election will be free and fair, or do you think it's going to be a sham?
So, I was in Zimbabwe earlier this year, and an advisor for Raila Odinga was in Zimbabwe at the same time. You know, he was there to advise Morgan Tsvangirai. So, mm-hmm. Which is quite a cool story in itself. You got African opposition parties working together.
Sort of like when Musi Maimane went to visit Zambian dude.
Although, yeah, exactly. That was a debacle in its own right. But what Odinga's advisor said at the time, you know, behind closed doors, off the record, was that Odinga knows he can't win the election. You know, Kenyatta will always have that 1 or 2% that kind of comes with being the incumbent. You know, you have some advantages from being the president. Odinga's had figured out he's not going to overcome that. So his plan was not to win the election, but it was to force another government of national unity. And that way, everybody gets to be at the trough eating at the same time. And that was his advice to Morgan Tsvangirai, was you're not going to win the Zimbabwean election. You need to discredit the election and make sure the stakes are high enough. And the reading between the lines of that, you know, do make sure there's enough violence to make it a big issue. And then at some point you can enter into negotiations where then everybody gets what they want. And my feeling is still that that is where this is going, because the election is not really not going to happen. We just can't fix the problems of the last election in a month's time.
All right. I didn't want to start with negatives, because right alongside Kenya is a place called Rwanda, which you've written an awesome article about called, you said, like it or not, Rwanda is Africa's future. And I thought that was interesting, because I'm hearing such great things about Rwanda from everybody. We've got almost like a benevolent dictatorship going on over there.
It is the most fascinating place. I arrived in Kigali, and I spent the first 24 hours looking for a chip packet on the floor, or a coffee cup, or a piece of paper, or a plastic bag, any piece of rubbish. I couldn't find it. 24 hours before I found my first piece of rubbish in Kigali.
So it's clean.
It's spotless. It's beautiful. It is a magnificent city. And you can see the development is happening. New buildings sprouting up. New housing estates. It's clean. The healthcare facilities are great. There are wonderful things going on.
Something so amazing about, you know, if people have self-respect, if you believe in your own dignity, to live like that.
The story gets more interesting, Gareth.
Sure.
Because then you start noticing, you know, this is still one of the poorest countries in the world.
Yeah.
And
it only emerged
alongside,
from that genocidal lunacy of Burundi and Rwanda, what, how many years ago? 20?
About 20, 25. Along with the absence of rubbish, you start noticing other things that are missing. Where are the homeless people? Where are the beggars? And you don't see them anywhere. And of course you sort of think, oh, this is great. There are no homeless people. There are no beggars. You do a bit of research and you figure out that what happens is the government rounds up beggars from the street and puts them in an open air detention island, where they're kept indefinitely for quote unquote rehabilitation. And I mean, Human Rights Watch has done a few fantastic investigations into how this happens. And I mean, it is basically a prison camp where crime of
being
not having a home, for the crime of being poor, you get banished to prison.
Oh my word.
Another story. You know, it's incredibly safe, which is wonderful. I can walk around Kigali 2 a.m. in the morning with my laptop, with my camera. No one would touch me. There's a couple of reasons for this. Reason number one, hiding in the bushes, and also like there's visible policing, and there's also police sort of hiding in the bushes. But every 100, 200 meters or so, there's a policeman with a machine gun. That's quite a scary way to live.
Whoa.
And it's easy to maintain security when you have that level of military and armed police presence, right? The other reason is the penalties for small crimes, right? Not officially, not in the law system, but again, Human Rights Watch, who has done fantastic work in Rwanda. Earlier this year, there was a guy who stole a bunch of bananas from the market. He got shot in the head.
Oh, my goodness.
Now,
so he died.
He died.
Well.
And the question we have to ask ourselves is, Rwanda is a fantastic example of African development. The statistics are pretty good, if we can believe the statistics, and there's some question about that. But at what cost? Are we moving forward by sacrificing, you know, basic human rights, basic human dignities? And that's what worries me. And I feel that even if Rwanda can pull it off, and that's debatable, this idea that Rwanda is a role model for us is really worrying, because guys like Robert Mugabe, right? What are they going to take from the Rwanda model? Are they going to take the fantastic development and great healthcare? Or are they going to take the, oh, we can just shoot the criminals in the back of the head?
To control them.
And that's before we get into the whole, you know, the fact that there is no opposition, there is no political space, there is no freedom of speech in Rwanda whatsoever. These are things that are important, and they're important for the long-term health of a country. So most countries that go along this path of a, you know, of a benevolent dictator, they can keep it up, maybe for a generation, maybe for two generations if they're lucky, but it all does fall down. Again, Zimbabwe is a great example. When Mugabe came to power, he was Kagame. He was the savior. He was the guy that changed the education and brought in the healthcare and did wonderful things for Zimbabwe. And at the time, we all ignored the stories of Gukurahundi, where, you know, tens if not hundreds of thousands of people were killed in cold blood, because we were like, oh, you know, it's a necessary sacrifice for that development. But what's happened to that development? Should we have all, raised our voices earlier? And I kind of think that's where we are with Kagame.
Sure.
But he's such a good PR tactician. He is just wonderful at spinning his own propaganda, and we all want a good news story. We want a great African story to believe in. Mm. And he's saying, well, here I am. Here's your story. And we're lapping it up. And it's dangerous, and I'm really worried.
Sure.
I'd love to get your thoughts on Grace Mugabe. The assumption here is that once Robert can no longer do what he does, Grace is going to take over, right?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think Grace is strong enough.
Ah.
She has no political constituency of her own. And she is so tarnished by all these scandals. And that's why...
That's never stopped the president, though.
That hasn't, but he's in power. So it's easy when you're in power to brush that stuff off. And that's why Grace can do it now, because she's connected to the power. But once Bob goes, I think it's going to be really hard for her to take over without causing... we're not talking about a general sort of... no one's going to revolt in the general population. I don't think there'll be an Arab Spring-style thing in Zimbabwe. But within the ZANU-PF structures, within the elites, they hate her. They can't stand her. And they're already doing everything they can to get rid of her.
So who are the other potential candidates within the ZANU-PF?
So the main one is a guy called Emmerson Mnangagwa, who... is also not a very nice guy. So it's not like he's going to be much of an improvement on what Grace would have been.
We really pick him, huh?
they really pick
themselves and force themselves upon us.
What I'm most frustrated with in Zimbabwe at the moment is not the shenanigans within ZANU, because of course we know these are a bunch of bad dudes fighting over who gets to control things. But I'm really worried about what's happening in the opposition. Morgan Tsvangirai has done incredible things for Zimbabwe over the years, but he's been in charge of the MDC for a long time.
Yeah, I almost forgot that he existed for a while.
And running into the new elections, here you have the same old face on the same old party. There's been no leadership renewal, and he's sick. He's been suffering from cancer, which he's luckily been able to fight. But we don't need another Zimbabwean president who keeps running off to be in hospital.
How old is he,
Morgan? I think he must be late 50s, early 60s maybe.
But he's had this really hard life. I wonder whether he's the right guy for the job. So that's a disaster. Zambia is also a bit of a disaster in terms of opposition politics at the moment, right? What's happening there?
Well, there's been some good news in that the opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema,
finally got out of prison.
He's out of jail.
Hichilema.
What was he in for?
Trumped up treason. He was driving. Let me get this right.
Okay.
He was driving. This is the most ridiculous thing, right? He was driving to some event, and the president was driving to some event. And because the president wanted the bells and whistles and to get there first, Hichilema got there first. The president said, "This is treasonous." So they locked him up.
Hichilema refused to move out of the way allow the president to
arrive first.
Yeah.
And that's treason.
That's treason.
Kind of like how we get pushed off the roads by the Blue Light Brigade.
But no, I've seen the video of this incident. And it's not a great road. It's a tiny little road.
There's not a lot of room.
There's not like a shoulder you can pull over to. There wasn't really much choice.
And for that to be called treason, these are egos out of control. This makes Trump look like he's got his under control.
Well, see, what I think is happening here is this is connected to Trump. Because somewhere like Zambia... has a long history of being pretty peaceful, pretty relaxed,
Up to a while ago, they were starting to get their act together.
Exactly. And then you get President Lungu, who comes in, and he kind of suddenly takes the pulse of the international community. He's like, if I want to get a bit more dictatorial, if I want to take a bit more power, who's going to stop me? Is Trump's America going to stop me? No, they're not. They're not going to say a word, and they haven't. is South Africa going to stop me? Well, Zuma's a bit preoccupied at the moment, and he's not exactly a paragon of sort of wonderful governance himself, so he's not going to say anything, and sure enough, we haven't said anything. And so for a good few months, Lunga was just able to keep doing his thing, and no one said a word, and it was quite interesting. Eventually, the Commonwealth Secretariat stepped in. Now, who knows what the Commonwealth is? They have not been a major factor in politics for at least a decade.
Yeah.
But in the wake of Brexit, this is one of the UK's big things, is to revitalize the Commonwealth. So they sent in the Commonwealth and got Hichilema released. Like, that's all it took. All it took was like one big international player saying, hey, hey, calm down. Let's roll this back a little bit. And he did, because, you know, he's not really trying to fight this. He's not really a Mugabe, in how he's trained and stuff. So he wasn't going to go all the way, but we're letting him. And I think South Africa plays a big role in this. We're so distracted by our internal problems that we're forgetting our role as a sort of continental leader, and we're letting people get away with stuff.
And are there any hopes in Zambia of things kind of becoming a little more balanced? Because when you can lock up the opposition leader just for not letting you pass on a road,
it's
how much does the rule of law matter?
Yeah, exactly. Look, I think so Hichilema and Lungu are entering into like a political dialogue, and that'll be interesting to see what comes out of that and what happens next. I think for now, everything will sort of stay.
Why does it feel to me, with all of these leaders we've discussed so far, the Mugabes, the Lungus, the Kagames, that the people are just witness to whatever goes on? They're not participants in their own future. They're not participants in their own destiny. Why does it feel to me like there are so many people on this continent of ours who just accept that that's their fate? Are they afraid? Are they cowed into submission? Are they what the colonial racists of the past would have said, servile and happy to be ruled over? I mean, what kind of agency do the ordinary citizens of Rwanda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe have?
Look, I think it changes from context to context, but protests are expensive. Demonstrating is expensive. You know, the Arab Spring is a good example. You know, I was in Tahrir Square when everything was going down. The people in Tahrir Square, sort of at the beginning, were overwhelmingly middle class.
Mm-hmm.
They had the means to go, you know, to not work
the time as for well.
Weeks. They had the time. They could do this, and they could organize, and they could get things going.
But Simon, in Zim, 70-odd% of the population is unemployed and are poor. They are dirt poor.
But unemployed doesn't mean you're not working, Gareth. Unemployed means you're working even harder because you're hustling every hour of the day.
Isn't desperation the best motivation sometimes? How much worse does it have to get in Zim?
But it's also the idea is what change can we make?
This is what I'm saying. Don't these people have a sense of their own agency? And I know this is what a lot of South Africans, usually xenophobic South Africans, say about Zimbabweans who come here. They say, oh, well, they're going to set up a shop in our township. We should beat them up because what are they doing here? Why don't they go and save their own country? That's an awful way to think about people. But at the same time, there is something about this that troubles me. There's no tipping point at any stage in the future. It's like, well, we'll just keep on keeping on. We'll just keep being ruled over like this. It seems to me almost like it's futile.
I kind of look at it differently, Gareth. And Zimbabwe is really interesting because what Zimbabweans have essentially decided to do, and I think that's almost visionary, is they have said, okay, we actually don't need a government. Successive governments over generations, over centuries even, have let us down. They have not delivered anything. We are going to be the most resilient society in the world. We're basically going to operate by ourselves.
And how's that working for them?
It's working well.
How?
It's working as well as they can. Like,
is
they're
that
making
why so
the
many
best,
live here?
They're making the best out of a really hard situation.
Is that why so many want to leave and get the hell out?
Because they're looking for new opportunities, but that's what people do. That's what everyone does.
No, I'm not saying absolutely, but this is not a country that should be so unstable.
No, it shouldn't. But it's a country that's lost faith in any government.
Listen, you're speaking my language because I don't believe that the state is the answer to any of our questions. But in Zim, it almost feels to me like there's an abjection. There's like a... giving up almost. Like, oh, let these people just loot. Let the ZANU guys just do whatever they want, and we'll just hopefully escape their yoke as often as we can. And if there's one or two occasions where someone gets killed or someone disappears, and we'll just quietly get on with our lives.
But we're also speaking on it as outsiders. Absolutely. Looking in, not having a full understanding, exactly, of the psyche,
yeah,
and the impact that the psychology of this period that they've gone through has had on them.
Yeah. And we have zero understanding of that. From a very privileged perspective of, we're used to having freedom, yeah, of expression, we're used to having freedom of demonstration, we're used to having freedom of the press. So we kind of take these things for granted. Yeah, Zimbabwe does not have any of
that. You don't get given those things. South Africans know. Black South Africans, mm-hmm, in particular know. Those things are hard fought and hard won. They're not things that are just going to be given to you. The Queen is not going to fly out on a plane
and Zimbabweans
say to people, now you have freedom of speech. Robert Mugabe is not going to suddenly walk out into his balcony one day and go, let them have cake and some freedom of speech. It's something that you have to fight for. And this is why you're here, because I want to know what it is that holds these people in thrall, whether it's in Zambia, because the average Zambian is not participating in their democracy. Here you have these two leaders, the opposition and the incumbent, meeting and talking about things in some rarefied atmosphere of teacups and suits. And the average Zambian is out there tilling the fields or looking after their livestock or trying to start a little business somewhere, but they have no participation in the system. And the same goes for Kagame's people in Rwanda.
I think that's true almost anywhere. Is actually the number of people involved in politics is minuscule. The protests we have in this country today, they're negligible. They don't even register on any scale. People in this country,
civil society is so active here.
Oh, is it?
It is.
Or is it just
absolutely
a small? No. It's a small group of very loud people.
I think social media has changed that a lot.
Social media is not active.
More participants. No, it isn't.
And Zimbabwe has a very thriving, very antagonistic towards the government social media scene that doesn't translate into people on the street like it doesn't here.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole Gupta thing, I mean, this is actually, I've been quite shocked by how passive South Africa has been,
yeah,
in the face of the state capture stuff. We've had like what, one, maybe two big marches, and they weren't even very big. I think across the whole world at the moment, we're in a phase where people are becoming more passive. They don't think they have the power to change things. Where things have changed, it has not been for the better, aka referencing the Arab Spring, which, yeah, I think is something we need to.
Yeah. So maybe,
and Zimbabweans are not stupid. Like the Zimbabwean civil society people I've spoken to, they study that. You know, they've gone to people involved in Egypt and in Tunisia, and they've said, what happened? What went wrong? How do you avoid it?
Maybe there's disenchantment. Huh? Maybe it's kind of accept our lot now. Well, you raise a good point, and this is really one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. The other places, though, that I want to pay some attention to, because we've got a long list. Let's just talk about Cameroon. This is an interesting country. Mabs, you remember that woman with the giant orange hair?
Oracine?
No, not Oracine Williams. Paul Biya's wife. Who's the president of Cameroon?
Yes, it's coming back to me now. Let me look up a picture.
You know what we're talking about, right, Simon? So what's Paul Biya's story? He's still there?
He's still there. He's having a bit of a tough time at the moment. So he's been in power for since the 1980s.
Oh.
He's an old school dinosaur. But Cameroon's a really interesting country because, you know, you've got this across the whole of Africa, you've got this sort of Francophone versus Anglophone divide, mm-hmm, the old French colonies and the old English colonies. And it's incredible the way that the colonial divisions replicate themselves in the modern world. We still talk about this and it's still real. Mm-hmm. You know, they're quite different beasts, but Cameroon is mostly Francophone, but it has a little Anglophone section, and that Anglophone section has pretty much been sidelined and marginalized and discriminated against by Paul Biya's government. And
we'll even use colonial reasons to hate each other. What is wrong with us here in Africa that we can't make friends?
It's conditioning us.
There was this extraordinary
turn
story
us against ourselves
from Anglophone Cameroon. And one of the leaders was saying, and one of the main issues is that Anglophone Cameroon wants to be governed by British colonial rules instead of French colonial rules.
What?
Which is absurd, and it just shows how the country hasn't, you know, it hasn't developed its own set of rules that for the whole country. It's crazy. But Paul Beer's dealing with that, and how he's dealing with it is basically arresting anyone involved in protesting or advocating for secession and shutting up media. At the same time, he's dealing with Boko Haram in the north because as Nigeria has got more effective at dealing with Boko Haram, they're moving into Cameroon and trying to do stuff there. I just saw yesterday that Cameroon is building a 140-kilometer trench along its border with Nigeria to try and stop suicide bombers from coming in.
Wow.
Which is quite extraordinary. And, you know,
it's like Donald Trump's wall.
Exactly like Donald Trump's wall. And you wonder just how effective something like that could be. I have the feeling it's more of a good PR move for Beer, because the history of walls is that they don't really work. So I'm not sure that this one's going to be any different. But you want some good news stories, guys.
Well, just tell me about his wife's hair for a second. She's got a gigantic... Mubs, do you want to try and describe it?
Look, it's a wig, obviously. it's very tall. It stands tall above her head. And then it's also very long, cascades all the way down to her shoulders. And I mean, it is orange. It's orange.
But the wig doesn't know what it's doing. Is it curly or is it straight? It's like...
That's the most fascinating thing about Cameroon. I can't help thinking that every time I hear the name of that country, I think of her. She's really done... She's done
what a legacy.
Whatever she's done, she's imprinted herself on my brain. I'll tell you what. Can't get away from that. Okay, let's talk about West Africa, because there are some good stories that you wanted to go into anyway. So they're teaching the rest of us a few lessons about peaceful transitions and power.
Yes.
Tell me more.
There was this 2 years ago in Accra, capital of Ghana. There was this incredible meeting of ECOWAS, which is their version of SADC. And all the presidents came to the meeting and they were like, you know what? We've had enough of this bullshit of dictators staying in for life. This has to end now. What we're going to do is we're going to limit every single president in our little block in West Africa to only 2 terms in office. That's the maximum. Everyone. And how many people voted for it? 13 out of 15.
Brilliant.
That's extraordinary.
Brilliant.
Extraordinary.
Who were those two assholes who said no?
Oh, well, this is where it gets interesting. Asshole number one.
Yeah.
The Gambia.
Oh, now we know them.
We know what happened to the Gambia, right?
Remind us.
Earlier this year, the president lost, and end of last year, the president lost an election, which is crazy. Mm. He was trying to rig it, but he just was so incompetent, not only at being president, but also at rigging elections, that he lost his own rigged elections. And then he tried to roll it back and be like, oh, no. No, then he said, this was extraordinary, he said, no, the elections were rigged, so we can't accept the results.
Oh. Okay.
Which I thought was kind of brilliant.
That's a pretty good move.
But ECOWAS were like, we're not going to stand for this.
By the way, the Gambia is just really, it's just a river, really.
Yes.
It's a bank on either side of a river. It's the tiniest little country. The capital is on the coast. Who's the guy?
Barrow, Adama Barrow. Right.
And it's just a river.
Yeah.
And that's all there
that's
is.
That's all it is.
It really shouldn't even have been invited to this conference.
Shame.
So did ECOWAS then climb into him?
ECOWAS sent 3 presidents to the capital to be like, this isn't happening. They put 4,000 troops on the borders of the Gambia to say, if you don't listen to us, we're going to fuck you up. Excuse me. I don't know if I can say that, right?
You can say that, yeah.
And then... Sure enough.
fuck you up.
That's probably what they said exactly.
This is the funny thing. We all think politics is all about détente and
decorum.
Actually, I think when these presidents got into the room with him, they said, Barrow, I'm going to tell you, if you do not stop your nonsense, we're going to fuck you up.
Yes.
And sure enough, he got on his little private plane with a stash of gold and fled into exile in Equatorial Guinea. They got rid.
Let me guess. Equatorial Guinea is the other country that voted no.
Equatorial Guinea is in Central Africa, so they're not part of it. But they would have, because they're also, the other country that voted no is Togo. Now, Togo at the moment is last week 100,000 Togolese went on the streets to tell their president to get out. They're 100, really 100,000, and this is a tiny country
because he's overstayed his welcome
by a long way. So he's I think he's been in power for 10 years or so, but his dad was in power for 40 years before that. So it's a family affair, and they were like, we've had enough of this. We want change. And we are going to get out on the streets. And they have been ever since. Regular demonstrations, getting bigger and bigger. A couple of people have died during them thanks to, you know, a police response. And lots of people have been arrested, but they're still going. So there is, when the opportunity is right, that popular resistance is there. And I'm really quite happy. So now you've had the Gambia has fallen. Mm-hmm. And Togo is, you know, on the brink. He might stay, he might go, but if that happens, then you have the whole of West Africa basically having governments that are committed to elections, committed to democracy, committed to peaceful transitions of power, and prepared to enforce them. That's the incredible thing. You know, South Africa also committed to democracy and peaceful transitions of power, but we're not enforcing that in Zimbabwe or anywhere else. West Africa is. Mm. They are setting the groundwork, and we have a lot to learn from them.
Right. Good news. Okay, so there are sort of highlights there. Can we talk about Angola? That, you know, this is a country that it's a massive, massive country, and not that far from us, really. We do quite a lot with them. I know that our president is flying around. I think he went to China in a jet recently, that is actually owned by Dos Santos's daughter.
I did not know that. Yeah. Doesn't surprise me though.
Very interesting. Because this is really it's a crime family that run Angola. It's sort of like when Saddam and his two sons were running Iraq.
You know, it comes down to parenting in the end, right? The Mugabes are clearly terrible parents, and that's why Mugabe has no progyny, to take over and run his empire. Whereas Dos Santos, he must have been a good parent because he's got Isabel dos Santos, the daughter.
Richest woman in Africa.
Richest woman in Africa. Now, of course, we know this is through incredible corruption and being close to the president. We know this. You still have to be smart to pull that off. You know, organized crime is, it's an industry. You need to be clever to do organized crime.
Yeah, you need to be strategic.
Exactly.
You need to be.
You need brains.
You need the right.
The mafia
elements.
Dons are not dumb. They're.
You can't be this lickspittle kind of Zuma Gupta thing.
Exactly.
It doesn't work so well.
So you got this Isabel dos Santos, who is really smart. The other son, who's running the sovereign wealth fund, and there's, I think, $5 billion in the sovereign wealth fund. He's also really smart. So what dos Santos has done, because he has stepped down now, he's officially. I'm not sure if the inauguration, has the changeover happened or not.
Victory for democracy.
No, definitely not. What he's done is he's been like, okay, I'm going to step down because if I don't step down, I'm going to start getting into trouble. Mm. Perhaps. And mostly from within his own party. So that's, of course, where contestation happens in these countries. It's not really anywhere else. It's within the party. So let me step down. I'm going to hand power over to a patsy who can just keep things in check for me. Uh-huh. But I'm going to make sure that my kids control all of the money. And that's the sovereign wealth fund and the oil company. And that is literally, that's the whole Angolan economy.
Right.
And the Dos Santos kids have it. So as long as he control his kids, his family are controlling the money, he can relax, go back to his lovely mansion he's built somewhere.
He's worked
in
hard.
Rwanda. Yeah, yeah. But also cunningly, he's made sure he's still chairperson of the party. And that's, of course, where the real decisions are made, because it's effectively a one-party state to all intents and purposes.
All right, so he's got that one wrapped up nicely.
Nice and in the bag.
What about our friends in Mozambique? How are they doing?
Our friends in Mozambique, they've already spent all their gas bonanza on a fleet of tuna boats that doesn't meet EU specifications, so cannot be used to catch tuna for export.
So then, what happens now? What happens now?
What a sad story. You know, you talk about the whole country of Mozambique, and Simon comes in with, "Well, they bought a bad fleet of tuna boats." Jesus, how depressing!
It is. It is depressing, no, but it's symptomatic of a government that's not governing for anything else than lining their own pockets.
But can we quickly go back to Zim since we're in that area? Mm. So what is propping up this regime? You wrote something about illicit diamonds.
The diamonds are a big one. So in the about 10 years ago, Zimbabwe discovered all these diamonds, incredible, vast diamond wealth. They estimate they've sold about, you know, they estimate there's about $15 billion worth of Zimbabwean diamonds on the market,
mm-hmm.
Of which only about $2 or $3 billion has been accounted for. So most of it is happening illicitly, illegally.
Are these from Zim or are they from the DRC?
They're from Zim. They're from the Maranga diamond fields.
Right.
And Global Witness, they're a big sort of international investigative outfit. They did an incredible investigation into where all this money went. And basically, a lot of it went to dodgy foreign companies involved in Zim, but the big part of it went to different branches of the ruling elite. So some went to the Central Intelligence Agency office, I think. Some went to the army, different branches of the army. Some went to a person who's very closely associated with the president. And that is how the regime sustains itself. So in an economy, and this is an interesting thing about Zim's economic crisis, because if there are no dollars in the market, and you know we know that Zim has a huge currency shortage. There's a shortage of dollars. They're huge bank queues. If there are no dollars in the market, the people who have access to dollars are the kings. And the people that have access to those dollars via the diamonds are the various bits of the ruling machinery. So that's kind of how the state is propping itself up, because they are still the only people that can pay anyone.
You say, you know, there are these dynastic families in Africa. Mm. There are real royal families too. There's Swaziland and Lesotho. We never really refer to them very much.
So there's a new Swazi wife, I believe.
Mm. Oh yeah, 19 years old.
And the 14th?
Daughter of a cabinet minister, which I can imagine is a little awkward.
Oh my.
But then, then this is an absolute monarchy. It is an of the old monarchy. Feudal kind. The only absolute monarchies left in the world, I think, are in Swaziland and Saudi Arabia.
It's extraordinary that it still exists.
It's like a throwback to the 1300s.
Yeah. And he's so young, Mswati. He's got a long way ahead of him.
Yeah, what is he, 50 what now?
Yeah, he's probably in his 50s, 40s maybe. I don't know. But what is there any chance that things might, and I'm not saying you need to get rid of the king, but that things might progress a little for the people of Swaziland, or are they happy with what's going on?
I think it's pretty, the economic situation there is bleak, exceptionally bleak. Same for Lesotho. But these countries are so tiny that
they're dependent on us, right?
They are entirely dependent on us. I mean, our customs, the customs union we have with Swaziland and Lesotho, I think it accounts for more than half of both those countries' foreign earnings.
So if we had a president who believed in democracy and we had a huge international support base from which to draw money and the impetus for change, and we decided it was time to let the people of Swaziland decide, we could actually change things.
I really do think so. I think that South Africa has that moral and diplomatic authority. It is a heavyweight. It has the economic authority to make change happen, certainly within the Southern African region. We are the superpower. So why don't we use that power is the question.
Which countries have you not been to yet that you're really keen to go to?
I am going to Central African Republic probably next month or maybe November.
What
I haven't been there.
What the hell is happening there? Because that's one of the few countries on this continent I know nothing about.
So it is.
I don't know a lot, but I know something about all of the others. That one I know nothing.
You know, so it had that civil war when the South African troops were killed.
Yes.
In the Battle of Bangui. And, you know, huge contingent of peacekeepers went in, and it kind of stabilized. You know, it still wasn't great. The humanitarian situation was bad.
They've
the
also
fighting
got a problem
down
with Boko Haram,
bit.
Don't they?
No, not Boko Haram in the CAR. They have a group called Seleka.
That's right.
Which is a sort of loosely Muslim-affiliated rebel group, but I don't think they're defined by religion in the same way Boko Haram is. And they also have some so-called Christian militias called the Anti-Balaka that So a lot of the fighting is either between the Antibalaka or between the Antibalaka and the Seleka. It's a
does everything
mess.
End in ka?
But what's really interesting, so things kind of calmed down over the last couple of years. Still bad situation, but relatively calm. And then, remember Stop Coney?
Yes. John Coney.
Joseph Kony.
Yes. All those millennials who did so much to throw him out, and he's
just
stayed.
And then the US sent in a force to go and hunt Kony, mm-hmm. as did the Ugandans.
I remember this was like 2012, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Mm.
And that force went in, and of course they didn't find Kony because they had no idea what they were doing. but they were looking for Kony in the Central African Republic, in the eastern part of it. And so what they did was the Ugandans went and they set up bases in all the major towns in the eastern Central African Republic looking for Kony. Mm-hmm. What that meant was they were also sort of accidentally acting as peacekeepers, mm-hmm. because there was this armed contingent of troops there, so no one could really do anything. The search for Kony was called off a few months ago. And so all those troops went back. The US troops went back. The Ugandan troops went back.
Vacuum of power.
And the vacuum has led to a huge surge in the fighting. Mm. And what I find incredible is how these things are all interconnected. So you have Joseph Kony, who is from northern Uganda, and he wanders around that region. Well, you stop fighting him, and then suddenly something else. It's like a...
So he's still around, the Lord's Resistance Army, right?
Yes.
And where is, do we have any idea of where he is at the moment, what he's up to?
Not really. The LRA's activities have sort of scaled down dramatically. So they've struggled to keep up their size because of all the sort of military intervention they've been facing. But they're very good at wandering. So they wander between sort of South Sudan, Central African Republic, Uganda. And they're just constantly on the move, and no one can find them. Mm. And it shows how little we know about those areas, because even the people that live in those areas, that govern those areas, don't know where he is or how to find him.
Jeez, what an incredible place. Yeah, really, you could get lost here. All right, which countries are bad for media? Where are you afraid to go because things might go wrong?
You know, it's tricky. So as a white South African male, I'm in a very different category. You know, I have certain things that make it easier for me to do my job in a lot of countries. Mm. Being white helps, because I'm usually perceived as an international, which means people sort of treat me with a little bit more caution. Being male helps, as it does almost everywhere, because I get a lot less attention of the sort of unwanted kind. And then being South African is also really helpful because...
Is it helpful?
It's
because
extremely helpful. Okay. Less helpful than it used to be, but still helpful. Because when I do get in this tricky situation, and it has happened a couple of times, where I might get detained by police or whatever, being South African, means I'm less of a threat than being English or being American. It's usually perceived as. So I'm in kind of a good space in terms of myself and where I'm comfortable reporting. That said,
let me guess,
there are still places that make me nervous.
Okay, Equatorial Guinea?
Not so much there. You know, mm-hmm. I think I'd be... They don't really have... The places that make me nervous are the places that are really efficient and organized.
Oh.
And that's not Equatorial Guinea.
No.
It's places like Ethiopia, where I'm currently unwelcome for a story I wrote. And that's because...
Politically correct you are unwelcome. It's like a nice thing. You are unwelcome to dinner.
Because what will happen when you go there is they'll fuck you up.
Hospitality has not been extended to you.
That's what will happen.
You are unwelcome at a dinner. In a country, you are banned.
Wow.
So, but Ethiopia has such an efficient intelligence service that I have no doubt that when I rock up at the airport in Addis Ababa, they will draw the dots and they will pick it up.
Oh, wow.
The same with Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is really scary. The last time I left Zimbabwe, I got interrogated by the central intelligence officers, and they knew all kinds of things about me. Mm. Stuff from both my trip in Zimbabwe, which makes sense. They were probably watching. But stuff from other parts of my career, which they have no right to know, and I don't know how they, you know, were able to get hold of this information. That scares me, because that's the level of organization that can, you know, that can catch up with you and can reach you in other places. So I definitely say Zim, Ethiopia, and probably Rwanda are the three places that scare me most to work in as a journalist.
the efficient places. That is not the answer I was expecting. Mm. All right. Well, what's the best place in Africa to live?
Ooh, Johannesburg, of course.
Listen,
we're doing something right.
Well done on all your reporting from across the continent. This is fascinating stuff. I know I'm not the only one who loves to hear about it. There's so much when it comes to things like Rwanda, and you're telling me about these islands with people that they're rehabilitating. Mm. It's frightening. But there are stories around every corner. And thank God your huge department of one is looking after you.
Yes. Working feverishly and tirelessly.
Let's not forget, people of Africa, that there is a way forward, and that is the ECOWAS way, where the presidents all get together and they say to bad presidents, we will fuck you up.
Yes. Let that be our motto.
That's our motto for the morning.
This is CliffCentral.com.